From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So do Republicans have the votes to pass the health care bill unveiled yesterday? That's one question in Washington. Another has been answered. There were no tapes. In an interview with Fox News this morning, President Trump confirmed his tweet yesterday in which he said he didn't have any tapes of conversations with former FBI Director James Comey. That's contrary to his tweet of 6 weeks ago in which he insinuated that he did have tapes. This was just after firing Comey. But this morning, the president didn't quite put an end to the question of recordings.
So you never know what's out there, but I didn't tape, and I don't have any tape, and I didn't tape. But when he found out that that there may be tapes out there, whether it's governmental tapes or anything else, and who knows, I think his story may have changed. I mean, you'll have to take a look at that.
Let's bring in our political roundtable. Joining us today, Chad Pergram, who covers covers Congress for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Hey there.
And Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, is with us as well. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the health care bill that came out yesterday from Senate Republicans. President Trump spoke about the four Republicans who came out against the Senate bill as it's written just hours after it was made public.
I think we're going to get there. We have four very good people that... And it's not that they're opposed. They'd like to get certain changes. And we'll see if we can take care of that.
Chad, what are you hearing at this point about how likely Senate Republicans are to get the votes they need to pass this bill?
Well, a lot of times what you try to do is you try to apply leverage. In fact, that's the term that Rand Paul, the Republican senator from Kentucky, one of the four who are opposed to this bill on the record right now, used. And when you do this, when you put yourself out there as saying, I'm opposed to something, you give yourself a seat at the table. Maybe this is a way to get a provision worked into this bill that is favorable for your state or district. It's good optics. It shows that you're fighting. You're just not going to take this laying down, and then you actually prevail maybe in the end and you got there. You cannot change congressional mathematics. There are 52 Republicans in the Senate. They can only lose two, and that's the idea that they would have a 50-50 tie, and then Vice President Pence would come in and break the tie. If they're down to 48, and there's a bunch of other senators who are in play here, I would look at Dean Heller from Nevada, a swing state. He's up next year in Nevada. So is Ted Cruz, one of the other members who's opposed. Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia. And some of the members don't want to talk about this. They're very much on the fence. Lisa Murkowski, the Republican senator from Alaska, was going into the Senate chamber a couple of days ago, and a few of us asked her in the hallway, hey, do you want to talk about health care? And she kind of hollered over her shoulder, not really. That kind of tells you what people think about it.
Well, Chad and Enrique, let's remind people why they're opposed. I mean, the four senators that President Trump was referring to are opposed to the bill as it stands from the senators because they don't think it goes as far as they'd like to see it go in dismantling Obamacare. I mean, some of the senators, the Republican senators that may be opposed, are the moderates who think that it goes too far. So let's hear from Rand Paul, one of the four who said they are not supporting it because it looks too much like Obamacare, doesn't go far enough. He spoke on NBC's Today Show this morning.
We have more government subsidies in our bill, perhaps, than Obamacare has. Our bill may cost more in the first 2 years than Obamacare cost.
Let me
ask
you.
That's not repeal.
So, Enrique, what is that doing right now? And actually, Chad, I'd love you to weigh in on this after Enrique. You know, this is President Trump called the House version mean. This feels like senators saying it's not mean enough.
Well, I think I agree with the fact that it sounds more like posturing than actual opposition to the bill. And taking a step back, Robin, we have to realize that this is the first item in Trump's legislative agenda. And we're 5 months into the administration. So it's really important that they find a way to strike the right balance between moderates and so-called ultra-conservatives, the case of Ted Cruz with this negotiation. I really don't see how that's going to happen. 50-50 might be an outcome, but at the end of the day, this White House is going to have to learn to operate in Congress under investigation and find a way to advance their legislative agenda.
Well, Chad, your thoughts, too, about, is this making the Republican Party look mean? Meaner.
Well, it was funny. That's exactly what Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, did yesterday. He brought out a placard at his press conference. It said mean. You know, that was the word that the president used to describe the bill. And then Chuck Schumer produced a magic marker and wrote ER at the end of mean, meaner. And he underscored it a couple of times there. That's obviously how the Democrats want to portray this. What I find unique about this entire process is that Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, I asked him, you wouldn't bring a bill to the floor if you didn't think you had the votes. It's clear at this point in time, he doesn't have the votes. He is rolling the dice. He has said, you know, we've litigated Obamacare for 7 years. He's almost daring his members to vote against this. Are you really going to get to this point in time and not do it? It's now or never. And that is a gamble by Mitch McConnell. It's a big gamble because they are using this special budget reconciliation process, which lowers that bar to 50-51, because you're not going to have a filibuster. If you used it as a garden variety bill, you'd have a problem. If you burn that reconciliation package, it's done. They cannot repeal and replace Obamacare. It's that simple.
And then Obamacare stays, which would be really That's something right. after years of campaigning against it. Enrique, there are no tapes, says President Trump, of conversations with James Comey. What do you make of that, that after all that, there were no tapes?
Well, it took a while to get that confirmation. And it's been a trend in the White House. Until the president decides to publicly confirm or deny something, the White House is not doing its job of communicating that message. It's just waiting for to see what the president is going to say at the end of the day. And there's a larger theme of lack of transparency that worries me, because we've seen this movie before, only in Spanish, in other places around Latin America. And the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability and access, it's worrisome. And it's also being, I think, a theme throughout these 5 months and change.
Well, is it also, Chad, sort of making this whole scenario that we have now possible? I mean, you know, everybody has said that if he hadn't, it was the president's tweet about tapes, which prompted Comey to leak to The New York Times that in his conversations with the president had pressured him to back off the Michael Flynn investigation. That prompted the hiring of a special counsel, Robert Mueller. And now an investigation may never find collusion with Russia, but may result in presidential obstruction of justice.
It seems that a lot of these this damage is self-inflicted. That's pretty clear. And this is why you have people like Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. He was party to a letter that they sent, a bipartisan letter they sent to the White House counsel, Don McGahn, saying, you know, are there tapes? If so, we on the House Intelligence Committee would like to listen to these and find out if they are actually there. They want a little more clarity. Adam Schiff told me yesterday, he said, you know, can we get a definitive statement? Is the president's tweet sufficient? Is that enough? And more so, was the president using this as a tactic to possibly intimidate other witnesses in this case? That's very key.
We have to talk about the Democrats, because there's a lot going on in the Democratic side after those two special elections this week's two special House races that Republicans won. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said she has the support to stay as her party's leader in the House, even though Democrats lost those elections. Here she is.
I respect any opinion that my members have, my decision about how long I stay is not up to them.
But this was Texas Democrat Philemon Vela on CNN this morning.
At the end of the day, what has to happen here is Leader Pelosi needs to ask herself, do I help or do I hurt Democratic candidates in those very important districts?
Enrique, as you watch this, what do you think? Is Pelosi going to be able to hold on, or do Democrats need a new leader?
It's interesting, because during the primaries, it seems that there was an ideological confrontation within the Democratic Party, and now it seems to be generational. Democrats are betting on Trump's unpopularity, his low favorable votes, to win the Senate back in 2018. And so far, we haven't seen them capitalize on those numbers, not in the special elections that we've seen so far. So I don't see how that's going to change in the next year and a half, and hopefully they have to make important changes. Otherwise, you know, they're destined to the same result.
Well, Chad, weigh in on that. After losing all the special elections, a couple this week, you know, what is the talk? What are you hearing Democrats say?
There is a mixed bag on Capitol Hill right now. I had one Democratic source tell me yesterday that they had never seen the Democratic caucus as, quote, torqued. That's the word that was used over this. And there's all these contortions here. I talked to another Democrat just within the past hour here on Capitol Hill who's had his differences with Nancy Pelosi. This Democrat did not want to be identified. And I said, well, do you think that Pelosi will disappear here? And the quote was this. This is pretty remarkable. Quote, she's like Trump. She could shoot somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue and nothing would happen.
I like what she said. I'm worth the trouble.
Well, that's the balancing act that the Democrats have to weigh right now. I will say this. If Nancy Pelosi feels that she does not have the support of the Democratic caucus, we will know. She is the best vote counter on Capitol Hill. I remember last year when she was running against Tim Ryan for the Democratic leader position. she was going onto the floor, and myself and another reporter asked her, how much of the caucus do you have? What's the support? And I thought she said three-fourths. And I said, three-fourths? And she stuck her head out around the door. She said, no, two-thirds, Chad, two-thirds. Guess what the vote was? 67% to the number. Mm.
But it was brought up on our show this week that the Democrats are going to need to be more than just anti-Trump if they want to win. Enrique, your thoughts just in the 30 seconds we have left.
Well, of course, I think they realized that after the election, a message that resonates with the working class voter. It has to be mainly economical. Tax reform will be a big deal, I think, and we'll see some of what the Democrats are thinking of in terms of their message. So definitely, I think that it can't be just the other candidate is crazy and supporting Trump, because that's clearly not enough.
That's Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. Chad Pergram covers Congress for Fox News. Gentlemen, we thank you both. And,
you
know, onward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Aside from the resignation of CEO Travis Kalanick, we got another piece of news from Uber this week. It's rolling out a new function in its ride-sharing app to allow tipping. The company says in-app tipping should be available to all drivers in the U.S. by the end of July. It's something drivers had wanted for a while. Similar apps such as Lyft already have it. But how much should you tip your driver? Joining us now is Steve Dublonica, a self-described recovering ex-waiter from New Jersey. He's also author of Waiter Rant and Keep the Change, a clueless tipper's quest to become the guru of the gratuity. Steve, welcome to Here and Now.
Pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
And any idea how much people should tip Uber drivers?
Well, the standard tip for a taxi is 15 to 20%. And that is my initial reaction. I say, well, tip 15% or to 20% of the fare. But things get really dicey with Uber, you know, because they have dynamic pricing. You know, what might be a $40 ride to the airport at 3 in the afternoon could be a $150 ride,
right,
you know, at peak time. Do you tip 20% on 150? So the problem with this new technology is it kind of strains our old ways about thinking about tips.
Well, and everybody who uses Uber is used to not having to tip. I mean, I have to say, and I feel bad for the drivers in a sense, but that's one of the nice things about Uber is you don't have to think about that, and now you will.
Right. Well, you know, Starbucks used to have a thing where you couldn't tip on credit cards or their gift cards, you know, so there was a technological separation between you and the tip. The same thing happens with the in-app thing. You know, with the cabbie, you actually have to pay the cab driver.
Right.
And in Uber, you can just say bye, you know, walk out of the car. And that's a problem. And I do think that the Uber drivers need tips, because when you look at their compensation, you know, Uber claims they're making $17 to $20 an hour, but a study in Canada said after they pay their cut to Uber and pay for their gas and tolls and everything, they're making like $460 Canadian an hour. So they kind of do need your tips, the same way cab drivers need tips to help meet their bottom line.
If you don't tip, is that rude?
I think it's rude. I think one of the things about Uber is they can now, you know, they can rate you. The cabbie can't rate you. He's never going to see you again. But, you know, the driver in Uber can say, you know, he could the lack of a tip could lead to a lower score, which could make it harder for you to get an Uber in the future. But just in terms of just being a decent human being, I think it's a good idea to tip the driver. But the question is how much do you tip the driver? And we're going to have to see how Uber sets up their in-app policy. Is it going to be a percentage? Is it going to be a set amount? I mean, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to do it yet.
Well, and do you think that the rating that the driver gives you will be based solely on how much of a tip you give the driver?
I don't think it should be. I think, you know, yes, you know, one of the great pleasures of Uber over a cab is it's your driver. He comes exactly when you want it. You know, so this is kind of what you're paying for, you know, for Uber. So the customer has a role in, you know, showing up and being a good customer. And I think that should impact the rating. But yeah, it's inevitable. You know, when I was a waiter, if you were a bad tipper, that affected my view of you and my service to you in the future.
What's a bad tipper in a restaurant, do you think? How much? What percent?
Well, normal restaurant tips, 15 to 20%. And that's why I always tell people, when in doubt, if you're in doubt about tipping, tip. and 15% to 20% is always a good rule.
I would think that some waiters would be annoyed with 15% at this point. They're so used to 20.
I know, but but in New York City they're going, "Oh, we want 25%," and I'm like, and I used to be a waiter, and I balk at that. 15% to 20% is the standard gratuity. And anything below 15% is not fun. But I remember I had a customer who would stiff me repeatedly, like leave like 5%, 6%. And then they call up on Valentine's Day and they want the most romantic table in the front of the restaurant. And I seat them by the men's room. So that, you know, that's what happens when you're a bad tipper. People remember that.
All right. Well, that brings us to the idea of additional tips. Some places they put in, you know, 18% or 15% included gratuity, yeah. But then you have an option for an additional tip, which Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm made fun of in a season 7 episode. Here he is out for a meal with friends and they're getting ready to pay the bill.
So you know what they do here? It's an 18% tip included.
Yeah.
And then they have a space for an additional tip. You know, I have to start doing math in my head now. And then what does it come out to? $2? I'm leaving an extra $2. That makes me look cheap.
No, just leave the 18 and let's go.
Decided. I think that's all they expect.
I'm not leaving any more additional tips here.
No.
I'm protesting it. I swear to you, I'm going to protest it. I don't think it's right.
I'm going
to
follow
stupid.
Your lead. It's a good protest.
This is crazy.
Okay, so what are your thoughts on additional tips?
Additional tips. One of the things I like to bring up is, why do we have tipping, right? And one of the reasons we have tipping is to subsidize the wages of the waiter. You, the dining public, right? Or you, the Uber riding public,
right?
Are subsidizing this so the owner or the shareholders aren't paying the living wage. So I always tell people, remember that. And the additional gratuity, very often what happens is the additional gratuity is there for two reasons. It's there automatically to prevent people from not tipping, which I support, or it's a service charge, right, that is tacked on to, you know, so they call it the tipless restaurant. You know, they may call it an 18% tip, or they just call it a service charge. And then they take that money and they divide it up in such a Byzantine way that the kitchen staff's getting paid out of it, the waiter's getting paid out of it. And then I think an additional gratuity, tipping on top of that is kind of ridiculous, you know.
So you wouldn't leave an additional tip?
I mean, my thing is I would leave if the service was extraordinary, but if they're at – I'm going to tip better than 18%. That's the thing that always got me is personally as a former waiter, I will always tip over 18%, but very often that is in for parties of six or more because there's something we call diffusion of tip responsibility. Oh, he'll get the tip. Oh, he'll get the tip. And then someone will walk out and not and there's no tip at all. Hmm. So that's what it's designed to do. But if it's a service charge, then I wouldn't leave an additional gratuity.
Okay, one more question about tipping that's been asked around the office here. What do you tip for a haircut?
15% to 20%, which means, ladies, you're getting hosed. That's it. I just had a discussion today with my coworker, and she said, "I had a $400 hair job once." And I said, "Well, did you tip 20%? She said, "No way." The thing is, it's interesting. You go to a diner and you have a $350 tip, you'll probably toss a $5. That's a great tip. But when checks get higher or bills get higher, the tips percentage-wise go down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what happens when the bills get higher and higher. But yes, it's expected that it's 15 to 20% for a haircut.
Is there anything that you don't tip for that some people do tip for?
I wrote a book on tipping, and I'm constantly afraid I'll be exposed as a hypocrite. So I'm always tipping. I'm a pretty good tipper. If I haven't tipped somebody, it's because it was just complete, you know, intoxication or accident.
Mm. And it sounds like from what you're saying, generally 15 to 20%, you can't go wrong.
Is usually going to get you out of most situations. That's correct.
Out of situations. Steve Dublonica, who is the author of Waiter Rant and Keep the Change, A Clueless Tipper's Quest to Become the Guru of the Gratuity. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now to some new research about cancer. We know that being overweight puts women at greater risk for breast cancer, and obesity increases the chance that the cancer will come back after treatment. Well, it turns out that shedding extra pounds can help protect women under 60 from a recurrence of cancer, as Wendy Rigby from Texas Public Radio reports.
I had never had a mammogram, and I found a lump.
At age 50, Gina Caparelli was stunned by a breast cancer diagnosis that led to surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation.
It's hard. Physical, mental, spiritually, everything. It's a life-changing experience.
Since we started our treatment, how's your weight gone?
Up.
Caparelli's oncologist, Dr. Virginia Cacclamani of UT Health San Antonio Cancer Center, is a big advocate of controlling weight to stave off the return of breast cancer.
Lifestyle may actually help treat breast cancer as successfully as our chemotherapy does.
Cacclamani was part of a study published in the journal Cancer that showed women under 60 diagnosed with breast cancer can increase their chance of survival by losing weight. She says fat contains growth factors and hormones that can fuel cancer cells.
We store estrogen in our fat tissue. So the more fat we have, the more estrogen we have, and the more estrogen we have, we increase our risk of breast cancer coming back.
Women often gain weight during cancer treatment. They're sometimes prescribed steroids. Maybe they stop exercising. Some get depressed and turn to food for comfort. But many physicians believe cancer therapy isn't the time to stop healthy habits.
I think it's extremely important. Just because you're on chemotherapy doesn't really mean that the rest of your life needs to be on hold.
Patients like Gina Caparelli say it's difficult to live life as usual.
It's scary. It's a very scary disease because I live every day in fear that that's coming back.
But she's taken her doctor's advice.
I started walking. Every day I walk. I have to fight the fight.
Think about increasing your heart rate more than just walking.
Dr. Cacclamani acknowledges losing weight is not an easy task for most people.
It's a very hard conversation. What I typically say, listen, if it were easy, we would all be a size 2.
But Cacclamani believes breast cancer survivors who potentially have decades left to live will do hard things to decrease the risk of dying from the disease. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
Authorities in London said today the Grenfell Tower fire started in a freezer and that the outside cladding, what we would call siding, on the building failed safety tests. At least 79 people died in the fire on June 14th. Joining us now, BBC correspondent Lisa Hampley. And Lisa, what more can you tell us about the investigation into this fire?
Well, we've heard this morning that the police, they're very clear. They're looking into the possibility of criminal charges. And this morning, Detective Chief Superintendent Fiona McCormack from London's Metropolitan Police told us that they have done their own tests. They say the insulation and the cladding failed that small-scale test carried out by them. Now, these are similar to those being carried out by the government here. They've also confirmed that the fire started in a fridge freezer. That's something that everybody expected because to start with, when the fire crews arrived there, they put out a fire in a flat on the fourth floor. And then when they stood back, the fire then took hold on the outside and ripped through the cladding and the outside of the building and up right to the 24th floor so quickly. So that's one of the things they're looking into, but they do say it's a fridge freezer.
And they think it was an accident and not set purposefully.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's never been any question that it was purposeful. The whole question here is what happened, why it set fire so quickly, and people are talking about the insulation, the cladding. They only had one exit coming down. So when fire crews were going into the building, trying to get up the floors in the smoke, they were trying to get up where other people were trying to get out. So there was there are a number of problems with this high-rise building. And they've got a huge team of 250 specialist investigators now working hard on all aspects in the investigation.
Meanwhile, there aren't that many buildings of this size when you walk around London. What is it like right now to be there and to see this just destroyed tower.
It's distressing when you see it. You don't just look at the pictures, but you actually see it. It's shocking. You go past on the underground, on the overground tube line, and everybody goes silent when the tube goes past. You just can't believe this shell, this black shell. In this area of London, it's very unusual because it's the richest area of London. It's the richest borough. So you have very rich people living side by side with very poor people. And there's been a lot of concern that these people just aren't being heard. And we've been hearing a lot from the opposition in Parliament, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who has demanded a step change in the country's attitude to social housing here. Because London has a lot of tower blocks. There's a lot of money here. There are a lot of money, people making a lot of money out of real estate, but there are a lot of people who are living in quite a different world, and this has now all come to the forefront here. And we've also been hearing there's concerns with this cladding with other public buildings, leisure centres, and we've heard from the Department of Education here, they're asking all the local authorities to check schools to see if there's no cladding on the schools. And this morning we're hearing quite a lot about other local authorities around Britain which are looking into their cladding, and some buildings they are taking it down in other parts of London and three other areas here.
That's the BBC's Lisa Hampley joining us from London. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, Jeremy.
The skies over Syria are so crowded with planes and missiles, you wonder who's in charge of air traffic control. Actually, there is reportedly a hotline between U.S. and Russian military counterparts. Has that been disconnected? We'll get to that. But today, Russia's defense ministry announced it fired cruise missiles from ships in the Mediterranean at ISIS targets in Syria, destroying command centers and ammunition depots. On Tuesday, a U.S. F-15 fighter jet shot down an Iranian-made drone, the second time that's happened in the last month. And last Sunday, a U.S. fighter shot down a Syrian jet near Raqqa after it reportedly was too close to U.S.-backed forces. Of course, the U.S. started airstrikes on Syria in 2014, saying the target was ISIS. Moscow followed a year later, saying the same thing, but Russia supports President Assad, so the U.S. has suspected that Russia was actually striking forces opposed to Assad. As we said, this is complicated. Who's the air traffic controller? Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. He joins us now. And Phil, start with the Russia missile strikes announced today. What do we know?
This was something that came out from the Russian Defense Ministry. According to their statement, two frigates and one submarine in waters off Syria in the Mediterranean launched a number of cruise missiles against what it called ISIS targets near the Syrian city of Hama. We don't know exactly from independent sources what they were striking or what kind of damage they might have done, but this is something the Russians have done in the past with attacks by strategic bombers or from warships like these offshore to be able to demonstrate that they have a standoff strike capability very like the one that we know the United States has demonstrated in the past. President Trump ordered American warships to use cruise missiles to attack a Syrian airbase earlier this year, and this is the same type of thing, only in this case the weapons are Russian, the warships are Russian, and the targets are ISIS, as opposed to the anti-regime forces the Russians have also been attacking.
Well, and the President Trump's attacks were after it was reported that President Assad's forces, or at least forces supporting Syria, had made chemical attacks on civilians there. But do we know if the Russian claim is true that they are attacking ISIS and no longer, as it was suspected, they were no longer attacking Syrians who are against Assad?
What we understand from defense officials before this is that there have been some Russian attacks on mutually agreed terror targets, including ISIS in Syria. But the lion's share of Russia's military operations are not focused on the Islamic State. They're focused on helping the Syrian regime of President Bashar Assad defeat anti-government forces on the ground militarily. There have also been assistance from regular Russian forces in terms of weapons and advice and ammunition and equipment for the ground troops that are loyal to Damascus. So it isn't as though the Russians haven't attacked any ISIS targets or any terrorist targets, but most of the time they're not doing that, although the politics for them are to focus on those claims because they make the case, as you mentioned a moment ago, that they're in Syria because they're fighting terrorism, just the same as the United States and the other actors there say that.
Well, when the U.S. shot down that Syrian jet last Sunday, Russia responded by saying it would be tracking U.S. planes as targets. And there were also reports that Russian officials said they'd be disconnecting this hotline that existed between the two countries so that they could stay out of each other's way. Does that hotline exist? Has it been disconnected? What do we know?
We don't know whether it's being used or not. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joe Dunford, said when he gave a press conference earlier this week that as of the time he left the Pentagon that morning, they were still using it. But from what we understand from defense officials and military sources in Syria is that the Russian use of it can be quite selective. Sometimes Americans in Syria will get on the radio or pick up the phone, metaphorically speaking, and say, here's where we're going to operate, or please keep your forces away from this area. And sometimes the Russians do it, and sometimes they don't, but they very seldom actually respond. So even though the channel is open, it's not as though there are people talking with two halves of a telephone conversation necessarily. Yeah. And that's one of the things that makes this situation so fraught. You don't know who is listening or what they're going to do at any given time.
Well, in the seconds we have, does that mean, I mean, it feels like there could be a confrontation between the U.S. and Russia in the skies over Syria.
It's a very risky situation. There's American warplanes, there's drones, there's Syrian warplanes, Syrian drones, Iranian drones, Syrian warplanes, and with no reliable system for keeping them all safely apart, the risk is that they could come into contact in an unfortunate way and potentially cause a flashpoint.
Yeah, even an accident. Phil Ewing, NPR's National Security Editor. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
And we have this update on the Yellowstone grizzly bear, an icon of the Western U.S. It's losing its status as an endangered species. The Interior Department announced yesterday that it's removing the protections after 42 years. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke says the bear's recovery is one of America's great conservation successes. But the issue is politically fraught in the West. The decision opens the door to hunting bears that wander outside the park's boundaries, and conservationists promised to sue. Well, we visited Yellowstone last August. Here Now's Peter O'Dowd met the park's bear biologist, Kerry Gunther, who described how the grizzly population has recovered since he started working there 30 years ago.
When I first started working in Yellowstone Park, it was pretty rare to see a grizzly bear. So if you saw a dozen bears in a summer, you considered that a pretty good bear year. Today, you can easily see a dozen bears in one morning.
So were there like a handful of them 30 years ago? And now how many? Do you have any estimates of how many there are?
Well, there's possibly as few as 136 in 1975, and now we believe there's well over 700.
Credit that rebound to the federal government's decision to list the bear as a threatened species back in 1975. It protected the animal from hunters and ranchers who often killed grizzly to protect their livestock. But along with the recovery comes more opportunity for danger.
We're working on our safety messaging because there's a lot more bears and visitation keeps increasing, so there's a lot more people. So we're having more encounters, and we're trying to get better at teaching people how to avoid having surprise encounters in the first place and then how to react if they do have a surprise encounter. One of the easiest things to do is find at least two friends to hike with. We almost never get anyone attacked that's hiking in a group of three or more. Bears respect things that are bigger than they are and that outnumber them.
Really, two is not enough.
Two is not enough. Two is better than one, but three is better than two. Now, if you do have a surprise encounter, initially what we recommend is slowly backing away, because a lot of times that'll diffuse the situation. But if the bear charges, you want to stop and stand your ground. Just by standing your ground, most of the time the bear's going to veer off if it charges or stop short.
Okay, Kerry, but I want to interrupt you there, because the thought of standing your ground when a grizzly bear, you know, several hundred pound animal is charging at you, every fiber of your being is going to be telling you to run the other direction, and you say you've just got to put your shoes in the ground and stay put.
Yes, and you know, when I first started working here over 30 years ago, that was a pretty tough thing to do. It took a lot of courage. Now today there's a product, bear spray, that's over 90% effective at stopping aggressive behavior in bears. And one of the big things with bear spray, it gives people the courage to stand their ground.
And I see you've got some bear spray in a holster on your hip right there.
If it's in your pack, again, a bear's going to be charging at about 44 feet per second, you don't have time to take a pack off and get bear spray out of a pocket. So you want to have it on a holster, either on your chest or on your hip, where you can get to it immediately.
What is it? It's just like pepper spray for bears?
It's a hot pepper spray for bears. It comes out in a really fine mist, so it gets into their eyes. They breathe it in, fills the lungs. The same type of product used by law enforcement, but it's hotter concentration, and it comes out in a big cloud, so you don't have to even be a good aim to use it. You just have to get it out, get the safety tab off, and press the trigger.
You got to do all that while your hands are shaking and while you've got a bear charging right down at you.
That's right. And so you want to practice ahead of time so that when the bear charges, it's instinctual that you know exactly what to do.
Okay, well, should we practice?
Let's practice.
Okay.
Yeah, let's see which way the wind's going here. This way. So I take the top of the holster off. You want to aim slightly downward. The bear, again, is coming in at about 44 feet per second. If you aim too high, it could run right underneath before that bear spray can settle down. So I aim just slightly downward, press the trigger. Whoa. And as the bear's running through it, you just keep spraying right into the bear's face.
Okay, so the spray really gets like what? I'm taking 1, 2, 3 steps here, and it seems a little bit of it in.
And it's still out there. It's expanding as it goes out, so it's harder to see, but it's drifting out there about 30 feet.
So a caution about using bear spray there from Yellowstone bear biologist Carrie Gunther with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd last August. We should say, by the way, that the park averages about 4 million visitors and has just one grizzly attack per year. And as we said at the outset, yesterday the Interior Department announced the Yellowstone grizzly will be removed from the endangered species list.
Nominees for the Television Critics Association Awards were announced on Monday, with the Hulu series The Handmaid's Tale, FX's Atlanta, and NBC's This Is Us leading the way with 4 nominations each. Voting for Emmy Award nominations began this week as well. HBO's political comedy Veep is expected to be recognized this year after taking home dozens of awards last year. Here's a clip from the latest season.
That is pure sexism. You call those people back and you tell them that I was the first female president of the United States and I will not work for less than 87 cents on the dollar.
Yes, ma'am.
And tell them I'll stand at a glass podium and wear a short skirt.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to preview the award shows. Hey, Eric.
You cannot go wrong with a clip from Veep.
I don't think so. This season has been wonderful, too. So we've got all of these new shows, not Veep, because Veep is on HBO, but I'm talking about all the shows coming from online streaming. There must just be so many possible shows for these awards shows to pick from.
Yeah, for example, I'm involved with the Television Critics Association's awards. There's 200 of us, and we kind of vote online, and we hand out awards in August. And it's just a way of the top critics in the country basically getting together and saying, hey, here's some really great work. And we try to pick stuff that maybe the Emmys might not honor, the Golden Globes might not necessarily honor. And it gives people a sense of, hey, you know, here's some stuff I might want to binge watch, or here's some stuff I might want to go back and check out if you haven't seen it already.
And last year at the TCA's, the FX true crime show, The People versus O.J. Simpson, won program of the year. What are your predictions this year?
Well, it's interesting. When you look at something like Outstanding New Program, for example, we got Atlanta, we got The Crown, we got The Good Place, we got The Handmaid's Tale, we got Stranger Things, and we got This Is Us. Now, for me, I feel like Handmaid's Tale was probably the best of all those shows, but I could see people choosing almost any one of these. This Is Us was also a favorite of mine, and Atlanta on FX was an amazing show, and a lot of people like The Crown, especially if they like British drama. You know, shows that are all great in their own way, and we're getting to the point where it's sort of, how does this show speak to you, and do you think this show speaks to a larger moment? For that reason, I'm willing to elevate The Handmaid's Tale over most any other show it's going to face this year, but I'm sure other critics would use different yardsticks.
I haven't seen The Handmaid's Tale yet, but
what?
The show, I just read
Let's stop right now, and you can just go to Hulu.
I need to watch it. Well, I just read the book is what I was going to say. I went and bought the book so I could read it, which is a great book. I can see why they decided to turn it into a show, which I will watch, Eric, I promise.
But, all right.
But when we talk about the TCAs, let's talk about some of the standout performers this year, which include past Oscar winners Nicole Kidman, Jessica Lange, Susan Sarandon. They're going to compete for the TCA Individual Achievement in Drama Award. They're expected to receive Emmy nods for their performances as well. But what about some of the more under-the-radar actors? Here's Aubrey Plaza in FX's Legion.
I'll say this. There's only one being in the vast multiplicity of space that matters. God. And do you know why God matters? Power. That is the point of what you call life.
So Aubrey Plaza is playing this character. On the one hand, the character is a friend of the lead character when he was ensconced in a mental institution. This is a mutant who has superpowers who also is mentally unstable. Aubrey Plaza played a character that was his best friend. But we find out as the show progresses that she's actually the manifestation of another entity that lives inside his head. So imagine the level of acting required to realize that. So I think there's actually a lot of actors that are sort of under the radar. Michael McKean on Better Call Saul plays the lead character's brother, also someone who struggles with mental issues, who believes that he is physically in pain when he's around electricity. This person, Asia Kate Dillon, an actor who does not have a gender designation and plays a character who does not have a gender designation on the Showtime series Billions. Ron Cephas Jones on This Is Us, he plays the biological father of one of the characters, and his character died, spoiler alert, in this recent season. The whole cast of Dear White People, if I could give these young actors sort of an ensemble award, I would do it. So there's a lot of great under-the-radar performances that people should be looking at while the Emmy voting is going on right now. It started a week ago Monday, and voting for the TV Critics Association Awards are going on right now, too.
Are you receiving bribes at this point from some of the contenders?
No, because I'm
They're spending millions of dollars, though, right, to try to sway the judges.
They really are. And it's all about trying to get chatter out in the press, trying to get chatter out into, you know, social media. You know, Lena Waithe, who's a cast member on Master of None, co-wrote an episode called Thanksgiving about how she, a black woman, came out to her mother. And it's a standout episode. People are calling it one of the best episodes of television this year. And of course, she's been out there talking about it. It raises people's consciousness about what's going on and affects their voting. And it might even affect those of us at the TCAs as well.
That's Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic and a TCA member and voter and former board member. Eric, thanks.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.